From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Another militant uprising in the Middle East. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Islamic insurgents today seized Tikrit, a provincial capital in Iraq. They may be on their way to Baghdad. U.S.-trained Iraqi soldiers have thrown off their uniforms and fled along with a half million civilian refugees. The so-called Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant, an offshoot of al-Qaeda, could be a game-changer for Iraq, Syria, Turkey, and U.S. interests in the Middle East. We'll hear about that and Defense Secretary Hagel's aggressive testimony on the swap for POW Bo Bergdahl. Today's talking point, political irony behind the Tea Party upset of a House Republican leader. First, here's the news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Alney back with To the Point. An Islamic group called Too Extreme by al-Qaeda is taking over some major areas in Iraq, including Tikrit, a provincial capital, and the oil-exporting city of Mosul, where 48 people are hostages in the Turkish consulate. What's in store for the rest of the Middle East? Today's talking point, House Majority Leader Eric Cantor has lost his GOP primary to the Tea Party forces he helped create. What's next for Congress and the resolution of partisan conflict? First, this news update. Before the House Armed Services Committee today, Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel defended the decision to swap five Taliban leaders for Sergeant Bo Bergdahl.
We made the right decision, and we did it for the right reasons, to bring home one of our own people.
Hagel said the administration complied with the law and fulfilled the commitment to recover all captive military personnel under precedents for prisoner exchanges, which go back to the Revolutionary War.
War is always about human beings. It's not about machines. War is a dirty business. And we don't like to deal with those realities. But realities, they are.
Jeremy Herb reports on the Defense Department for Politico. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Chuck Hagel speaks from experience. He is an enlisted man who was in the Vietnam War.
That's right. You know, he took a very combative tone today with lawmakers who tried to press him on why we made this swap. He wasn't having any of it when lawmakers said we were trying to negotiate with terrorists or that they should have been notified, and saying this was an extraordinary circumstance, and so, you know, this had to be done.
What about the notification of Congress in advance? That seems to be a legal requirement. What did the Defense Secretary say about it?
He said that they complied with the law. There's some debate over the president using a signing statement, something that he criticized President Bush for doing, questioning the constitutionality of that notification requirement. And so basically the secretary said, in this case, we weren't able to comply with it, and, you know, we're sorry, but that's the way it goes.
What about the allegations that Bergdahl himself was a deserter? Did that come up?
Both the secretary and Chairman Buck McKeon urged lawmakers not to talk about Bergdahl and his situation today, saying they wanted to focus on the hearing itself. It did come up, however. Congressman Jeff Miller, who heads the VA committee, asked why Bergdahl was still in Germany and when he wasn't brought back to the U.S. already, when others who have had, you know, greater combat injuries have been able to come back this quickly. Hagel was not happy with that line of questioning and said he did not like the implication the congressman was making.
So they didn't. The suggestion was that there was some problem with Bergdahl himself?
Well, and I think the suggestion that Hagel was referring to was the idea that, you know, that there was a reason they hadn't brought him back to start that whole questioning yet about, you know, the Army is going to investigate what happened and, you know, whether he did in fact desert and if that's going to lead to a court-martial or anything like that. And, the suggestion wasn't specifically put out there, but essentially, yeah, I think that Hagel was thinking that he was saying that it was being done for political in addition to medical reasons.
With regard to the five Taliban leaders that were exchanged, the people that had been held at Guantanamo Bay, it's been reported that at least one of them was an informer for the CIA and that a couple of them were, in fact, paid for, essentially, military leaders, militia leaders in Afghanistan had turned them in when nobody really knew much about them.
The Pentagon has disputed the claims that there was any money exchange as part of this. Today, Secretary Hagel talked about the five men being mid to high level Taliban commanders, and basically saying that, you know, these guys weren't directly responsible for carrying out attacks against the United States.
You mentioned the Republican chair of the committee, Congressman McKeon. What about Democrats? Were any of them defensive of Chuck Hagel and the administration?
You know, Democrats definitely took a more pleasant tone, I guess you could say, toward the secretary, but there was still some anger that Congress wasn't notified. Congressman Adam Smith, who's the top Democrat on the committee, said there was no reason that they shouldn't have gotten a 30-day notice, and that Congress is no worse than the administration when it comes to leaking details, which is one of the reasons the administration has cited for not telling Congress.
And there's been reports that a lot of people in the administration did know about it. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. 80 to 90 people between the Justice Department, the Pentagon, the Intelligence Committee, their communities. And so that's certainly one of the things I think that's driving this anger from Republicans, is that if that many people knew about it, you know, we could have been told too. Chairman McKeon cited specifically the fact that members of Congress knew about the Osama bin Laden raid before it was carried out. And so they're definitely questioning the precedent here.
We just heard the secretary say war is a dirty business. We don't like to deal with those realities, but realities they are. What about the criticism of the president for meeting with Bergdahl's parents and acting as if this was a great victory?
Yeah, you know, I think that has been driving the reason that this has turned into the political fight that it has. You know, they had the Rose Garden ceremony, you know, really touting it, and then all these questions came out about who Bergdahl was and what happened and then how he was captured. And that's certainly clouded the administration, and I think it drove the few questions we did get today at the hearing about Bergdahl himself.
So is this expected, this controversy expected to continue in Congress? Is the Senate going to take it up as well?
That's a very good question. The House Armed Services Committee is launching an investigation. They've asked for documents from the Defense Department about the exchange itself. The Senate hasn't said whether it's going to have an open hearing. They had a closed one yesterday, and Chairman Levin has said he's going to wait and see how things go before deciding on that.
Jeremy Herb with the Politico. Thanks a lot for being on our program.
Thanks for having me.
In a moment, another militant uprising in the Middle East on To the Point.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warman Alney back with To The Point. Yesterday it was Mosul, a major oil exporting city in Iraq. Today it's Tikrit, the hometown of former Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein and the provincial capital. The Islamic group called the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, or the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, appears to be moving toward Baghdad. That's according to Muhammad Ali Harisi, who is deputy bureau chief in Baghdad for Agence France-Presse. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for contacting me.
Tell us what you know about the group and about their forward movement. Do you really think they're on their way to Baghdad?
Well, they started yesterday with occupying Mosul and the whole province of Nineveh. And it's the first time that a militia controls the whole province in Iraq. Anyway, they controlled Mosul, they controlled Nineveh. They launched an offensive today against the province of Salah ad-Din, which is south of Nineveh. And easily, in a few hours, they managed to capture the capital of the province, Tikrit. And while everyone was surprised by this move and by how the army collapsed so quickly, they moved south, further south towards Baghdad. And they reached the city of Samarra, which is only 110 kilometers north of Baghdad. They tried to enter the city of Samarra, but there were some resistance and they couldn't. And Samarra is very symbolic because in 2006, when the Shia shrine, the big Shia shrine in Samarra was attacked, was bombed, there was a civil war in Iraq between the Sunni and the Shia. And this is very dangerous, and it's a very critical situation and very critical time for Iraq and the Iraqis.
When you say that they have control of a whole province or a whole city, these are large areas with a lot of people in them. How many people are now in control? Is it a very small number?
The militants, we don't have specific numbers, but experts and even security forces, they say that there are hundreds of these militants, and we have to keep in mind that these militants are moving in Sunni majority areas, and they have some supporters there. So it's a little bit easy for them to move, and it's a little bit more difficult for the army to defend, because the army is not the people living in Nineveh and Salah ad-Din are not big fans of the army, of the Iraqi army.
The army, of course, controlled by President al-Maliki, who
by
is...
By Prime Minister Nur al-Maliki, who is...
Prime Minister, thank you.
The government is not only composed of Shia, it's a national unity government, but it's led by the Shia. And Maliki has been governing the country since 2006, and he is accused of marginalizing the Sunni. So that's why in the Sunni areas, they hate the army, because they think or they feel that the army is the military wing of Maliki, whom they hate, and they accuse him of marginalizing them and attacking their politicians.
What can you tell us about this group that is the Islamic organization called the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, or the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant?
Well, this is the big question everyone is asking. How can a group like this militia control parts of a big country like Iraq, even in parts of Syria? I understand that in Syria there is a civil war and it's a little bit chaotic, but in Iraq it's a little bit different. But anyway, this group was founded in 2005, between 2005 and 2006, by Abu Mus'ab al-Zarqawi, who was killed by an American airstrike in 2006. And it was affiliated to Al-Qaeda. It was the Al-Qaeda wing in Iraq. But when the uprising started in Syria and this group started fighting with another jihadist groups like Jabhat al-Nusra, Qaeda said that this group is not affiliated to it anymore. And in February, they announced that this group is not related to the mother Al-Qaeda anymore. But this group is financed by businessmen, even in Mosul, before they captured Mosul, they were forcing people to pay them money. So they have many means of to finance themselves, and they are very equipped, and they have a long experience of fighting. This militia was one of the main militias fighting during the civil war in Iraq between 2006 and 2008.
Well, thank you very much for joining us. I know you don't have a lot of time. Mohammed Ali Harisi, a deputy bureau chief in Baghdad for the Agence France-Presse. Good to have you on our show. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Let me introduce Borju Daragahi, a familiar voice on our program, Middle East correspondent for the Financial Times, formerly the Baghdad bureau chief for the Los Angeles Times. Borju Daragahi, good to have you back with us.
It's my pleasure.
What can you tell us about this organization, where it has been gaining strength, and what its intentions seem to be?
Well, it's quite an extraordinary organization in that it's not like any of the other the Islamist groups that we've seen in the past in terms of its ambitions, in terms of its multinational operations. It operates in Iraq and Syria, and to a lesser extent in Lebanon as well. And it is, has a very bleak, dark vision for a sort of Islamic utopia that they actively try to establish already. They started out fighting the U.S. occupation and the Iraqi government in the 2000s. They evolved after the Syria war, moving into Syria, and then kind of moved back and forth between Syria and Iraq. And they're less interested in taking new territories, as they have in the last few days, than in establishing themselves in those territories. They paint municipal buildings black. They immediately try to set up their logo everywhere. They provide services, public services in many cases, and they try to institute a very harsh version of Islamic law in the areas they control. And it's really interesting. They have this sort of proto-state vision that's quite different from a lot of the other al-Qaeda and al-Qaeda offshoot groups that we've seen in the Middle East and North Africa.
How do they compare to the Taliban when they controlled Afghanistan?
Well, I think it's similar to that, in that they are also about sort of controlling territory. But, you know, the Taliban was quite a bit of a different organization in that they were the government. They had inherited the government. And they also, to a large extent, you know, did not have the sort of multi. They were like sort of rooted in the ethnic Pashtun minor or plurality of both Afghanistan and parts of Pakistan, but you know, did not have the sort of aspirations that the ISIS has.
The
Islamic State of, yeah, exactly.
Okay. You say they provide public services. What is their attitude toward civilians and the taking of or the causing of civilian casualties when they are moving as they are in a military way?
I think that's one of the most disturbing elements of ISIS. They seem to have, unlike other of the Syrian jihadi groups and Syrian militant groups, they seem to have absolutely no compunctions about civilian casualties. They seem to not care at all whether there are civilian casualties in their attacks. I think that's a legacy to a large extent of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, who was the leader of a predecessor organization, al-Qaeda in Iraq. And you know, that sort of bleak vision, that sort of disregard for civilian casualties pervades the organization to this day.
So you then are painting a picture of a very dangerous organization. Do you think that they will, as they again, it's hard to know what it means when people say they control cities, because I gather there are hundreds of them, but these are big cities. And how is it that they are able, do you think, to exert control?
Look, I think that to a large extent, they are just pummeling through territory and getting a lot of media attention that they totally thrive on. Their supporters and their suspected militants are very active on social media and Twitter, and they are just loving this. They love this attention. And I have a feeling that they're not going to even try to hold Mosul. I have a feeling that they've proved their point. I think that they've stolen a lot of resources from Mosul. They've gotten like a lot of items. It remains unclear as to whether they're going to try to stay in Mosul for now. I think that they will come back. They will continue to be a menace in Iraq. But you know, it's not really their style. And from what I understand of their numbers, they don't really have the numbers to hold such a huge territory. Now, there's this big caveat in that it's not just ISIS in this offensive. There are other Sunni insurgent groups, legacy organizations from the uprising against the U.S. occupation that are also fighting right now. And they've, you know, this sort of line between what is ISIS and what is a angry Sunni tribesman who is upset at the Maliki government, and the more Iraq-rooted traditional insurgent groups in Iraq. It's unclear where these lines are. But, you know, there's a good chance that they themselves, ISIS themselves, will recede if confronted by major Iraqi forces.
Borju Daragahi, once again now Middle East correspondent for the Financial Times, formerly Baghdad bureau chief for the Los Angeles Times. Max Boot is with us, another familiar voice on our program, senior fellow for national security studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, author of, among other books, The Savage Wars of Peace, Small Wars, and the Rise of American Power. He was a senior foreign policy advisor to the McCain and Romney presidential campaigns. Max Boot, good to have you back with us.
Good to be back.
What do you see happening here?
Nothing good. I mean, Iraq has been on a rapid elevator ride into the abyss ever since U.S. troops pulled out at the end of 2011. Almost literally within minutes of their pullout, Prime Minister Maliki began persecuting senior Sunni political figures now that he had been freed of effective American oversight. And he's essentially driven the Sunnis into opposition and implanted the feeling among the Sunni minority that they will not be effectively represented in the councils of government, which makes them much more amenable than they were in the past to cutting a deal with ISIS, with the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, which they now view as defending their interests against Shiite militias and the Shiite-dominated armed forces. And this is what has created the essential conditions, which has allowed ISIS, formerly known as al-Qaeda in Iraq, to rebound from its near defeat in 2007-2008. Earlier this year, it retook Fallujah, it took parts of Ramadi. Now it's taken Mosul, it's advancing south into Baiji and Tikrit, heading towards Baghdad. And there's very little to stand in their way other than Shiite militias backed by Iran. And together, those two forces can plunge very swiftly, plunge Iraq into the kind of horrific civil war which Syria is now experiencing.
You're suggesting, when you say that this all took place in the aftermath of U.S. withdrawal, the United States could have done something about this?
Well, I certainly think that there's no guarantees, but I certainly think that if U.S. forces had still been present in Iraq to act as advisors for the Iraqi security forces, the odds are that Iraq would be on a better path today than it actually is. I mean, this was the fear of those of us who argued that we should have kept an advisory force in Iraq past 2011. The fear was that if once they were gone, that these various sectarian groups, which don't trust one another, would start fighting once again because there was no buffer to stand in the way. And we acted as that essential buffer. Now the buffer is gone and the guns and bombs are out.
Back to Borju Dargahi with the Financial Times. Do you agree that the U.S., if it had left troops as advisors in Syria, might in fact have served as a buffer and perhaps have prevented what we're seeing today?
Possibly, but I think that the major blame for all that's happened, I think, goes to the Iraqi political class, which has been very irresponsible, especially those in positions of power. I mean, I think that Maliki gets a large share of the blame, but I also think that the Sunnis have been rather obstructionist and unconstructive in their political agenda and in their sort of promotion of their community's interests. I think the Kurds have been playing a maximalist game, trying to just suck what they can from Baghdad, get whatever concessions they can without thinking about the country as a whole. I think where the Obama administration may have failed more, more clearly, is in Syria and not doing anything about Syria and letting this state of chaos fester in Syria for 3 years thereby allowing this sort of vacuum that created the ideal environment for ISIS to flourish.
So when ISIS calls itself the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, the international aspect of it, I take it, is very important. Max Boot, you'd agree with that?
Absolutely. I mean, I think what we're seeing today is basically the collapse of the post-World War I borders of the Middle East. You're seeing the emergence of this Islamist caliphate stretching from, let's say, Aleppo in northern Syria to Mosul in northern Iraq. They've basically managed to erase the boundaries between the two states and to assert their control over this growing territory. That is an incredibly alarming development, especially when you look at the counterpart on the Shiite side, which is that in Syria, the portions of Syria which are not controlled by Sunni Islamist insurgents are now controlled by Shiite extremists, Hezbollah and the Quds Force and their local Alawite allies. And meanwhile, in Iraq, you're seeing something similar with an Iraqi version of Hezbollah and other Iranian-backed militant groups rising up once again to defend Shiite interests. That's an incredibly depressing and alarming development.
We're going to take a very brief break. We'll come back and continue this conversation on our talking point later, Political Irony Behind the Tea Party Upset of a House Republican Leader. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Jump into a new mode of music discovery with the KCRW Music Mine. It's our first iPad app dedicated entirely to music exploration. The Music Mine brings you an interactive experience with a constantly evolving galaxy of audio, video, and photos. Discover by artist, by DJ, or by song, and easily share the music you love with friends. The KCRW Music Mine. Dig into it on your iPad. More info at kcrw.com.
Warren Olney back with To The Point, talking today about the advances of the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria within Iraq and how it is taking over various cities, at least to the point of making the public relations of increasing its public relations portrait, I suppose you could say. According to Borju Deragahi, Max Boot says that perhaps it is a threat to the very borders of the states of the Middle East because it's operating in both Syria and Iraq. And he has indicated that he thinks that if the United States had left troops as advisors in Iraq, the situation might be not as dire as it is at the moment. I want to introduce Robert Musil. He is president of the Rachel Carson Council. He's also a senior fellow at the Center for Congressional and Presidential Studies at American University. He was as CEO of Physicians for Social Responsibility, and in that position, he led opposition to the Iraq War. He was a founder of the Win Without War Coalition. He is a veteran of Vietnam. Robert Musil, good to have you on our program.
Warren, it's good to be here and be perhaps a fresh voice.
Indeed. Glad to have you on our program. And tell us, if you will, what you think of the analysis we've heard so far. And do you think that the United States should have, in fact, stayed in Iraq, at least with advisory personnel, in the hope of preventing what we're seeing today?
Well, I guess the simple answer to that is no. I mean, some of the analysis I've heard has been excellent in understanding the nature of the Islamist forces, what's going on in the military situation, some of the failures of the Iraqi government. All of that is quite good, I agree with. The difficulty is the notion, I think, that the United States could solve this by a continuing military presence, whether it is small, called advisors, or larger. Part of what we argued back at the beginning of this war is that it would destabilize the region, that it would create increased militancy, that an American invasion and then occupation would lead to unrest, civilian casualties, refugees pouring into Syria, a whole series of things that have indeed come to pass. Now, that begs the question, of course, if, well, we did invade and President Bush did go ahead, even though I hope listeners will recall when I said I was involved with many people, but particularly nonprofit groups, advocacy groups, formed this huge coalition. We were able to mount things around the world, around the country, and I worked on the inside with people who brought forth amendments to try to prevent this occurrence. That's the Spratt Amendment got two-thirds of Democrats in the House of Representatives at the time, 155 votes, not to go ahead. John Spratt was from South Carolina. He and I were Army captains together. And there was plenty of intelligence that what we were being told about Saddam Hussein was not true, and that we took ads in the New York Times because we didn't get enough coverage in our opinion that laid out precisely what we're hearing now, that the long-range effect of this would be destabilization, increased militancy, terrorism. And so now the notion that to stay longer, to stay bigger, would just be to compound this. I suspect there were people in the British Empire and in the French Empire saying similar things about Baghdad, about Vietnam. I think it's important for us to understand that over the long haul, the United States cannot occupy and determine what is happening in some of these Mideast societies. So that's where I would disagree, and that's the simple answer. No.
Okay, that's a pretty complicated answer. Max Boot, let me go back to you. So you said that you predicted that this would happen because the U.S. withdrew its advisors. Robert Musil goes back further than that and says he predicted the destabilization of the entire Middle East because of the U.S. involvement.
Oh, I don't think we need to relitigate the decision to get involved in the Iraq War, which, whether you think that was right or wrong, it doesn't change the issue of where we are today. And I'm reminded of a comment that General Petraeus and Ambassador Crocker used to make. They used to say, just because we made a lot of mistakes getting into Iraq doesn't mean that we should make mistakes getting out. Unfortunately, the mistakes that we made getting into Iraq have now been compounded by the mistakes that we made getting out. And nobody is suggesting that we should have had an indefinite American occupation of Iraq. What I and many others, including our senior military commanders, suggested at the time was that we needed to keep an advisory force of perhaps 10,000 troops to support the Iraqi security forces and to provide leverage for us in trying to curtail the sectarian tendencies of Prime Minister Maliki and other Iraqi politicians. That's, you know, a much smaller force than we've kept in Germany, Japan, or South Korea over many decades, but I think it would have been incredibly important and allowed us to influence what happened in Iraq. That didn't happen. Instead, we left, washed our hands of it. President Obama said it was a great victory, but in reality, instead of ending the war, what President Obama's decision to pull all of our troops out, I think, has done, along with events in Syria and along with the very unwise decisions made by Prime Minister Maliki and other Iraqi politicos, what all that has done is enabled the war to restart with calamitous consequences, not only for Iraq, but for its neighbors and for American interests in the region.
So, Robert Musil, back to you. Have the mistakes of the war itself then been compounded by the nature of the withdrawal and perhaps the premature timing of the withdrawal?
Well, again, I don't think so. The question to compare Iraq to Germany, for example, and that we still have troops over there with a strong ally, a Western government, to Iraq, where it has always been stapled together and held together. I mean, earlier in the conversation, we were talking about the Kurds stepping up and overreaching. The whole question of a Kurdish state and separating off from Iraq has gone on for a very long time, and the fact that 10,000 American troops or advisors are standing around isn't going to change that reality. The tensions between Sunnis and Shiites have been there. The influence of Iran, you just have to look at the Iran-Iraq war. It's just the notion that if we would just hang on a little longer and help advise and support this government, that all will be well for the future. I just don't think it holds up in looking at the particular pieces of Iraqi society and the tensions that have been there and are now clearly back on the surface.
Okay, but we did go in. We were there. And do we have some sort of responsibility then to maintain whatever interests continue? Has our withdrawal simply led to a situation that's more chaotic than it needs to be?
Well, what are our interests? I mean, since we got back, and I know we don't want to do too much history, but if we look at Vietnam, as the U.S. withdrew, and then the communists, the North Vietnamese and LF took over the whole place. We all remember the pictures of the helicopters, and now we're doing business with the Vietnamese. And even Senator McCain has been involved in reconciliation with these deadly enemies, with communists, with a very different society. And so there were arguments at the time that if we just stayed a little longer, kept a few more advisors, but that wasn't working out. And so I think we do have an interest in the Middle East, but trying to redesign it, keep the boundaries, that's the part that gets very difficult, where I believe that we are playing out a long-range scenario that other Western powers have tried before and ultimately failed.
Let me go back to Borju Daragahi, our correspondent with the Financial Times. You mentioned earlier that you thought that President Obama had made a mistake by not taking more action in Syria. What could he have done? How would it have prevented the situation we see now with ISIS in Iraq?
Well, I would say I would expand it to not just include President Obama, but many Western powers did not focus perhaps enough attention on what was happening in Syria, particularly in the north of Syria. I think that one solution that has been advocated by the Syrian opposition and many people that I see as rather credible in the analyst community is perhaps having armed the more moderate elements of the Syrian rebellion much more earlier, given them the weapons so that they could stand up both to Bashar al-Assad and the extremists within their midst. And that one of those extremist groups is this group here right now. I also think that maybe it is a little, I mean, I'm not always on the same side of the issues as Max Boot, but I think that at this point, with the urgency of this issue right now in Iraq, it's threatening to Turkey. It's threatening to world energy supplies. It's threatening to one of the most important capitals in the Middle East. I think it might be really a mistake right now to rehash old debates about whether it was right or wrong to go into Iraq.
And Robert Musil, certainly the situation is different now, not just with regard to energy supplies and Turkey, but the organization involved is not comparable to anything that was going on in Vietnam. There was no organization such as ISIS that for example, killing its own people.
Well, Warren, I guess the question that I'd like to ask our other discussants is, are they suggesting that we put back in a serious military force, or what are the options that they would recommend at this point as militants are heading toward Baghdad?
Okay. Max Boot, what about it? What should we do now?
Well, it's very tough right now because our options are now severely limited because of several years of American neglect of Iraq. I think, in essence, what we need to understand is that just sending more military aid to the Iraqi government as currently constituted is not going to help, because Prime Minister Maliki is pursuing a sectarian agenda. He is not seen as an inclusive leader by the country's Sunnis. And until that changes, you're not going to see a fall off in support for ISIS. So I think what we ought to be doing right now, actually, is trying to exert whatever influence we have to try to convince Iraq's other political parties not to back Prime Minister Maliki for a third term. And they just had an election in Iraq where Prime Minister Maliki's party was the top vote getter, but he still needs a lot of support from other parties in order to have enough seats to form another government. And I think at this point, what we need to be doing above all is to try to push for the other political parties to find somebody else who can be a more inclusive leader, who can address some of these Sunni grievances. And that's actually the most important thing I think we can do right now to fight ISIS, instead of just sending more Hellfire missiles or F-16s or whatever. That's not going to help right now.
Borju Daragahi, what's your take? Do you think that that's a good idea? Is there a political kind of influence the United States could have that would be helpful?
I think that's the most urgent thing at this point, is just getting Maliki out of there. I mean, it's just so obvious that he's such a failure. I mean, if he had any honor at this point, he would resign. You know, he's lost the country's second largest city to insurgents. Even if it's temporary, it's humiliating, and it indicates just utter gross failure on so many levels. But, you know, I think that real attention needs to be paid. I think that Turkey needs to get involved. I think that, you know, even Iran needs to get involved. This is the one issue. ISIS is the one issue that pretty much unites all of the players in the region. I don't think any of the governments or even any of the non-state actors in the Middle East is supportive of ISIS. I think this is one issue where many, many people with different and even conflicting interests can get together and try to come up with something.
What's the relationship between Prime Minister Maliki and the government in Iran?
I think that the government in Iran is a staunch patron of Nouri Maliki's government. I think that Maliki has a very tangled relationship with Iran. He didn't have a great experience when he was there in exile. He's among the most anti-Iranian of the Shia religious politicians who are dominating the country. But he is dependent on Iran for security and political support.
So, Max Boot, could Iran, do you think, exert a kind of influence that would be helpful?
I doubt it, because what I see Iran's primary influence being is to support Shiite extremists within Iraq. And so what we've seen in the past is that when al-Qaeda gets strong, so do extremists on the Shiite side with Iranian support. In the past, there was Muqtada al-Sadr's Mahdist army, the Jaish al-Mahdi. Now it's groups like Kataib Hezbollah and Asab al-Haq, which are kind of successor organizations. So I see the Iranians exerting their primary influence to arm and to support and to train these groups to act as a countervailing Shiite militia, much as they're doing in Syria right now, where they're backing their Hezbollah proxies and their Quds force are backing various Alawite militias to attack the Sunni uprising against Bashar al-Assad. So I don't see Iran as being a positive force here. I see more Iranian influence leading to more polarization of the country. I think what we need in Iraq is a leader who can look and sound independent of Iran, as Maliki did at one point, as he did in 2008 when he was attacking the Jaish al-Mahdi and retaking control of Basra. He looked like a national leader. He no longer does. He's a failed leader. He looks like a sectarian leader. There's no way to solve the problems of Iraq right now without a more inclusive leader in charge in Baghdad. And Iran, I don't see them signing up to that because I think they see Maliki as being somebody who's essentially their cat's paw in Iraq.
Borja Dargahi, you mentioned Turkey several times. Turkey has said it will retaliate if any of the people now being held hostage at its consulate are harmed in any way. What do you expect from Turkey and the president there, who's got problems of his own?
Well, I think his problems are domestic. I think with regard to this issue, I think most Turks are on board with needing to do something about this. I mean, look, Mosul was once part of Turkey. They gave it up under duress. And there's a lot of ethnic Turkmen in this part of the country, in the northern part of Iraq. They are under threat. Some of them are of the Shia persuasion and are extremely vulnerable to ISIS's violent ideology. So I think that Turkey has a huge interest. Turkey has always been interested in northern Iraq. It has massive investments in Iraqi Kurdistan, and there is a chance it has in the past intervened and crossed the border militarily, even with airstrikes, to hit at Kurdish militants. Is it a possibility that they could cross to hit Sunni militants? That would be unprecedented, but not out of the question.
Okay, well, that's all the time we have. Thank you all very much for being on our program. We'll continue to see what's happening there. We'll continue also to look at what we talked about in the first part of our program, the situation with Bo Bergdahl, and I know all of you have views about that, so we'll take that up again in the near future as well. In the meantime, thanks for being on our program. Borzu Dargahi, Middle East correspondent for the Financial Times, Max Boot at the Council on Foreign Relations, his latest book, The Savage Wars of Peace, Small Wars and the Rise of American Power. Robert Musil, an unfamiliar guest. Hopefully you will be back again, the president of the Rachel Carson Council, opponent of the war in Iraq, a veteran of Vietnam, and now at American University. Thank you all once again for being on our show. It's great to have you with us, and we'll look forward to the next conversation. The Washington Post says that Tea Partier David Brat was more interested in campaigning to make a point than he was in winning. But win he did in yesterday's Virginia Republican primary against the most influential conservative in Congress, the House Majority Leader Eric Cantor. This is an event full of political irony, and we'll hear about that in a moment on To the Point.
Did you know that recycling your used car is a great way to become a KCRW member? You can donate your car, boat, motorcycle, or other vehicle in support of KCRW. It's one of the best ways to recycle. You'll not only benefit yourself with a KCRW membership and a nice tax deduction, but your car will help support all that you hear on KCRW, from music to news to your favorite cultural programs. We'll arrange everything from the pickup to the paperwork. For details, visit kcrw.com/cars.
Warren Olney back with today's talking point. Eric Cantor, the House Majority Leader, spent $5 million in yesterday's Republican primary. It's in a district near Richmond, Virginia. And his poll showed him 35 points ahead of college professor David Brat. Brat spent $200,000 to Cantor's $5 million. Brat won. Here's what he said to Sean Hannity on last night's Fox News.
God acts through people, and God acted through the people on my behalf. I had volunteers working just tirelessly across the counties. I tried to communicate that to the news media, what was going on, and it's hard to communicate that. But it was real, and it turned out we're just celebrating like crazy tonight. Just an unbelievable miracle.
Once again, Brat never thought he would win. Reportedly, he was a no-show at a meeting with key conservatives during his campaign, and that was in Washington, D.C., because he had to stay home and grade final exams. Norm Ornstein is resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. He writes weekly columns for the National Journal and The Atlantic, and he's co-author of It's Even Worse Than It Looks. Always good to have you on our program.
Always good to be with you, Warren.
How does it look now?
quite a day. Unexpected in a whole host of ways. Most of us yesterday who follow this stuff were looking more carefully at South Carolina, where Lindsey Graham was in a primary. This is a state, remember, where a very substantial number of local Republican committees had basically voted that to condemn Graham as a socialist. And we thought there was a very good chance he wouldn't get over 50% and would have to go to a runoff and might well lose his seat. He wins handily. And Cantor, in a shock to most people who've been following it, and maybe even a bigger shock to Eric Cantor, whose pollster had told him he would win by 30-plus points, goes down, the first time ever that a party leader has lost in a primary. And, of course, it's sending shockwaves through the Republican Party and the political arena.
Cantor says he will step down as majority leader by the end of July. What do you think is going to happen between now and then?
We're going to see a mad scramble in a whole host of ways for many leadership positions. Probably in the next hour or so, John Boehner will meet with the Republican conference and reportedly will say he's staying on as speaker. He is in charge. He will stabilize things. There will be an orderly process of succession. It won't be very orderly. One, it becomes a real challenge for the next in line in a party that doesn't particularly care about who's next in line. Kevin McCarthy, one of the young guns. And remember, it was these young guns. They did a book. It was Eric Cantor, Kevin McCarthy, and Paul Ryan, last time's vice presidential nominee, who led the effort in 2010 that encouraged, abetted, incited the Tea Party movement. It got him into the majority, and then it turned around and took Cantor as a victim. McCarthy would love to move up, but this is going to be highly problematic. And if he decides he wants to give up his position as whip to move up, he will face a challenge from at least Jeb Hensarling, a much more conservative figure, the chairman of the banking committee in the House, very possibly Pete Sessions, more conservative, the chairman of the rules committee, and probably at least a few others. One who's considering it, Kathy McMorris Rodgers, a woman who's trying to position herself to the right of Cantor and McCarthy, although that may be a little bit difficult for her. But very likely they're going to go significantly more to the right than Cantor was and than where McCarthy has been. And believe me, they're very far over to the right. He may decide to just simply try and hunker down and stay as whip. But there are a number of others, including the very conservative Steve Scalise of Louisiana, who's been the head of the Republican Study Committee, the right-wing caucus in a right-wing party, and Pete Roskam, who has been the chief deputy whip. We have some figures that are a part of the establishment. They're under siege from the more insurgent forces. Keep in mind that the establishment types would have been considered 10 years ago as very much over to the right. But now they're embattled. And we're going to have, I think, some great intrigue and very interesting ploys seen over the next few weeks.
So here we have we have been talking lately as if the establishment, now considerably to the right of what it used to be, had fought off the Tea Party challenge. We see now the Tea Party, and again, this is the primary irony, coming back and striking out against those figures that helped to create it. What does this mean for policy? What about immigration reform, for example?
It's not likely to be going anywhere. You know, it was odd, and it's not that this reflects a broad uprising in the grassroots in the larger sense on the immigration issue. You still have a substantial share of Republicans who would be happy to see immigration reform. Lindsey Graham, who's been a leader in the pro-reform movement, as we mentioned, did very well. But the activist base of the party is becoming increasingly hostile to anything related to immigration. And even though Eric Cantor was not a champion of major reform, he was trying to figure out a way to make something happen. He got hit by his opponent, Bratt, what a great name for an insurgent, as pro-amnesty. He ran ads saying he was against amnesty, Cantor did. But, you know, I think he was probably hurt as much by his equivocation or flip-flopping as anything else. But right now, because immigration was raised as an issue, and the national opinion leaders, Laura Ingraham, the radio talk show host, Mark Levin, the radio talk show host, Brent Bozell, the conservative activist figure, hit Cantor hard on the immigration issue. This is going to cause all other Republicans basically to take a step back and decide that even letting the word legalization pass through their lips, unless it is to condemn it, is something they want to shy away from for as long as they possibly can.
Let's quickly go back to the election or the failure to reelect Eric Cantor and the success of Professor Bratt. Very, very low turnout in that area, and it's a place where there's a lot of evangelicals, and we don't like to talk about these things out loud, but Cantor is Jewish.
You know, I wrote a little piece this morning in the New York Daily News that mentioned that one of many factors might well have been that Cantor, who was the only Jewish Republican in the House, had a district with a lot of evangelicals. And John Podhoretz, the conservative activist, tweeted, "Shame on you for even bringing that up." Now, it's not the largest factor. The fact is most evangelical Protestants, evangelical Christians, are not anti-Semitic, and most of them are very strongly pro-Israel and all of that. But to argue that this was not a factor at all, I think is a hard case to make. And, you know, let's face it, when you lose in a low turnout primary, although, you know, this wasn't very close, he lost 56-44, but you could think of a dozen factors that would make a difference, a couple of thousand votes here, a few thousand votes there. I think this was one of them.
All right, Norm Ornstein, it's always good to talk with you. Again, resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, co-author of the book It's Even Worse Than It Looks. And here's the subtitle, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism. thanks,
amen.
Norm. Thank you, as always.
Sure.
Also writing a new column for the National Journal and the Atlantic Magazine. Great to have you. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
Public Radio International.